to tonight's episode of the Malloy Program. Hope you have a good day. Had a good day. I paid a little bit of attention today. I'm not going to focus on this at all tonight. I paid a little bit of attention today to the punditry, the crazy people on all the cable channels everywhere, you know, talking about last night's elections. And the best I could come up with, was that. Remember last night, in my infinite wisdom, I said, don't pay any attention to any race other than New York 23rd and the Democrat won. So I celebrate the fact that the Republican Party has all of a sudden become very Stalinist. They are involved in utter purges now. There is no equivocation here. The long knives are out. The Stalinists are absolutely taking over the Republican Party. And I say, go for it, you dumbasses! Yes! That's enough. You know, that damned old torture issue just won't go away. Well, the fact that we are now, and have been for a number of years, a torture state, a torture country, kind of like Uzbekistan and Egypt, some of our great allies. And some that are really our allies where it concerns torture, but we don't like to call them our allies because it'll piss off Israel, you know, like Syria. To begin this, the Italians, an Italian judge sentenced 23 Americans to prison. 23 Americans sentenced to up to 8 years in prison today for the abduction of a Muslim cleric. The sentence is seen as a condemnation of the CIA rendition flights, so-called, used by the, as it's reported in Rome, the former U.S. government. Keep in mind, none of this has to do with Obama. Obama is building his own chamber of horrors. But right now we're focused, and we'll get to that in a minute, but right now we're focused on the Bush-Cheney Chamber of Horrors. All of these Americans, and they were mostly CIA operatives. I think one U.S. Air Force lieutenant colonel was also sentenced to 5 years. But they were all tried in absentia because the U.S. refused to extradite them to stand trial. Why not? Oh, that's right. Precedent. If we did that to the CIA agents, dear God, we'd have to do it to Henry Kissinger and Dick Cheney, and the list just goes on and on. So I can understand why we refuse to extradite them. But this is the first, the sentence was the first of its kind, and was seen as a positive step by people who understand, like you and I do, that this policy of rendition and torture violates just basic human rights. Of course, we're fighting a war on terror. And if that means that we have to get down and funky and be just as grim and miserable and murderous as the terrorists, well, it all works out because we're all fighting for the same thing, right? A pipeline! The prosecutor, one Armando Spataro, said, quote, "This decision sends a clear message to all governments that even in the fight against terrorism, you can't forsake the basic rights of our democracies," end quote. Well, you can, Mr. Prosecutor, and we continue to do so, as do a lot of countries, but your court's decision means that people can be held accountable. Now, what this means, with this conviction, and they are now, the 23 Americans are now considered to be, what do you call it? They're fleeing the justice of a court. They're fugitives, but more than that. Anyway, they have a fugitive status now, which means, essentially, but that perhaps they should not travel outside the United States. Because if they do, no matter where they are, they can now be arrested. by any government that recognizes the government of Italy. And I would imagine that would be just about every government on earth, I think. So these people can be arrested in any country and held and extradited. So be careful there, group. The sentence was handed down for the abduction of Egyptian-born cleric Hassan Mustafa Osama Nasr, who was snatched off a street in Milan in 2003 and flown to Egypt for torture. That's one of the deals that we have with Hosni Mubarak, the president, quote-quote, of Egypt. We provide him billions of dollars a year in foreign aid, just like we do Colombia and Israel. And in return, Mubarak turns over his torture chambers when necessary to extract false confessions from people that we ship to him. The heaviest sentence, 8 years in prison, was handed down to the former head of the CIA's Milan station, Robert Selden Lady, L-A-D-Y, Lady. 21 other former agents got 5 years each, and U.S. Air Force Colonel, Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Romano was also sentenced to 5 years. Charges were dropped against three Americans because of diplomatic immunity. Oh, the judge also ruled that those convicted should pay 1 million euros, which would be about $1.5 million in damages to the Muslim cleric, and half a million euros, about $750,000 damages to his wife. The cleric, who goes also by the name, he's better known as Abu Omar, was under surveillance by Italian police at the time of his abduction on suspicion of recruiting militants for Iraq. He was secretly flown from Aviano Air Base in northeast Italy, that's our air base, of course, via Ramstein Base in Germany, that's our base, of course, to Egypt, where he says he was tortured and held until 2007 without charge. He told Human Rights Watch, quote, "I was hung up like a slaughtered sheep and given electric shocks," end quote. Now, this is the first case that contests the practice of extraordinary rendition, which was invented by Dick Cheney and his staff of torture-happy thugs in the Bush crime family. A spokeswoman for Human Rights Watch said, quote, "This is clearly an historic verdict. It is a real testament to the tenacity of the Milan prosecutor's office that this case went forward." Italy's Il Giornale newspaper, owned by the family of the prime minister there, Berlusconi, quoted the CIA guy, Lady, CIA station chief, Lady, as saying, quote, "Of course it was an illegal operation, but that's our job. We're at war against terrorism," end quote. Of course it was an illegal. What do you expect? You expect to follow the law? And what was the cleric accused of doing? He was accused of recruiting Muslims in Italy to go to Iraq to fight the occupier. Let's see, what was the Abraham Lincoln Brigade? What is that reference where it concerns the Spanish-American War? Go ahead, look it up. Several American writers were part of, either in a combat role or as an ambulance driver of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. They were recruited in this country to... Well, you can look it up. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Molloy. Into a cold, dark space where she might never trace her way across this crooked mile, across this crooked page. Cry, freedom, cry from deep inside.
Because without dissent, it's not America. Here's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour, and without a web stream, it's not the Malloy program. I got a bunch of emails during that break. People say, hey, where's the stream? Is it working now? We pushed a couple of buttons here. Hope it's working now. The web stream. Hi. Continuing the darned old torture stories, the issue that just won't go away, you know, the gift from Dick Cheney that just keeps on giving and giving and giving. 23 Americans tried in absentia, found guilty. Now there's this from Raw Story, former UK ambassador to Uzbekistan says that the CIA sent people to that country to be tortured, and some of them were raped with broken bottles. It says the CIA relied on intelligence based on torture and prisoners in Uzbekistan. Of course, if you know anything about Uzbekistan, you know it's a country where torture is just everyday occurrences. But the people we sent there were tortured with practices including anally raping suspects with broken bottles. That's a country whose leader has no problem with boiling people alive. Now, you're familiar with that, right? Right? Okay. Now, this guy was the British ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray. He is now the rector of the University of Dundee in Scotland, and until 2004 was the UK's ambassador to Uzbekistan. He said the CIA not only relied on confessions gleaned through extreme torture, it sent terror suspects to Uzbekistan as part of the extraordinary rendition program that an Italian court found people guilty of, the very same practice today. At a lecture late last month, Craig Murray, the rector at University of Dundee, said, quote, I'm talking about people being raped with broken bottles. I'm talking of people having their children tortured in front of them until they sign a confession. I'm talking of people being boiled alive. And the intelligence from these torture sessions was being received by the CIA and was being passed on. End quote. Now, I mean, I've been aware, and perhaps you have also, that Uzbekistan is just, it's one of the open portals to hell. And it's run by a devil, borrowing from Christian iconography. It's a demon runs Uzbekistan. So naturally, we love him. We love him. We have bases there now, or a base, or we're building 3 or 4 or 6 or 20 or 30. We love the devil. We dance with the devil. We have sex with devils. And this guy, the guy who runs Uzbekistan, is one of the worst. Raped with broken bottles, having their children tortured in front of them until they signed a confession. Try to think about that. If you don't have kids, think about your niece or your nephew. Think about it. Think about it for a second. Just picture that. Kathy, can you picture that? I'm sitting here trying not to picture that where it concerns Molly. In 2007, Human Rights Watch declared that torture is endemic to Uzbekistan's, quote, justice system, end quote. Anyway, back to the former ambassador. He said he realized after his stint as ambassador that the CIA was sending people to be tortured in Uzbekistan, the country that he, anyone with a sense of a sack of cotton balls, is described as a totalitarian state. Never moved on from its communist era when it was part of the old Soviet Union. Suspects in Uzbekistan's gulags were, according to Craig Murray, quote, they were being told to confess to membership in Al-Qaeda. They were being told to confess they'd been in training camps in Afghanistan. They were being told to confess they had met Osama bin Laden in person. And the CIA intelligence constantly echoed these themes. He goes on, I was absolutely stunned. It changed my whole worldview in an instant. To be told that London knew that the intelligence coming from was coming from torture, that it was not illegal because our legal advisors had decided that under the United Nations Convention Against Torture, it is not illegal to obtain or use intelligence gained from torture as long as we don't do the torture ourselves. End quote. Now, usually when I'm doing this topic right about here is where I, you know, go, son of a bitch. But there's really no point in doing that. These are not new stories. These are just like every time you hear something released from one of the Dick Nixon's tapes from back in the, back during his reign of terror, you know, a little revelation, but it's nothing new. We knew that Dick Nixon also was a moral degenerate. But what we're getting here is, you know, dribs and drabs, little pieces keep coming out about the extent to which the torture was applied and the techniques, and the fact that one government, the Italian government, has now struck back against this system and said, you snatch this guy off our streets, you don't do that. We don't care what, we don't give a goddamn what you're fighting, you don't do that. There's more if you want to hear it. If not, I, you know, if you want to switch over and listen to some music, I understand.
The girls are sweeter there, Mindy and Guantanamo. We'll have a waterboard to share, Mindy and Guantanamo. Where the stubborn hell get around.
Your news unfiltered, only with Mike Malloy.
26 before the hour, this portion of the Mike Malloy Show is brought to you by the 1.6 million members of AFSCME, fighting for real healthcare reform. Back to the story about the former UK ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, who is now the rector at the University of Dundee in Scotland. What he talks about, the torture that went on in Uzbekistan, the information from the torture passed back to the CIA, all of it done under the direction of the CIA, and we're talking about serious torture now. We're not talking about loud rock music. We're not talking about telling someone that their hand was going to be placed in a box of spiders, although I don't think that is necessarily not severe torture also. But we're talking about now anal rape with broken bottles, hurting the children of the detainees in front of the detainee until the detainee said whatever the torturer asked, and boiling people alive? Mr. Murray says, I was absolutely stunned. It changed my whole worldview in an instant. To be told that the leaders in London knew the intelligence was coming from torture, but it was not illegal because we didn't do the torture ourselves. We sent people there. We kept the information. This is like Mengele. This is like doctors in the world who, after the horrors of the death camps were made public and people understood what had gone on there, and the so-called angel of death, the devil of death, Dr. Mengele, who escaped the justice, the experiments, quote-quote, that he performed on death camp detainees, Jews, homosexuals, identical twins, old people, the medical establishment more or less agreed that such research could never be used because of the conditions under which it had been obtained. Apparently, we're beyond that now. You see, if we torture people, let me rephrase that. If we send people to be tortured and then we stand back while the CIA suggest to the torturers what information is sought, and then we accept the information after that detainee sees his or her child being hurt. It's okay now because, you see, we didn't do the torturing. It's okay to use the records of Mengele because we didn't perform the experiments. And after all, it is good to know how long a human body can live when stripped naked and submerged into a tank of ice water. Gives us vital information about how to prepare for the ditching of U.S. military plane, for example, in the Arctic waters. We need to know this stuff. Now, the fact that the person or persons who were submerged in the tanks until they went into shock and died happened to be Jews or gypsies or gay people or liberals is really incidental to the medical information gathered, right? I mean, isn't that where we are? Yeah, aren't we right back to 1946? Aren't we right back there in this regard? Yes, you're goddamn right we are. We're right back there. That's where we are. That's who we are. Mr. Murray alleged that, or he asserts that the primary motivation for U.S. and British military involvement in Central Asia has to do with large natural gas deposits in Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan. As evidence, he points to the plans to build a natural gas pipeline through Afghanistan that would allow Western oil companies to avoid Russia and Iran when transporting natural gas out of the region. Murray alleged that in the late 1990s, the Uzbek ambassador to the U.S. met with then Texas Governor George W. Bush to discuss a pipeline for the region, and out of that meeting came agreements that would see Texas-based Enron gain the rights to Uzbekistan's natural gas deposits, while oil company Unocal worked on developing the Trans-Afghanistan pipeline. Mr. Murray said, quote, the consultant who was organizing this for Unocal was a certain Mr. Hamid Karzai, who is now president of Afghanistan, end quote. Now, you and I have known this for how long? 6-7 years? We've known this, all of this, for a long time. But who are you and I? we're nobody. I mean, you know, of course you're somebody. Of course I'm somebody. But you know what I mean. In the great big scheme of important people, we're nobody. But the former ambassador from the UK to Uzbekistan and now the rector at the University of Dundee in Scotland is somebody. The Italian court is staffed by people who are somebody. Right? Murray said that part of the motive in hyping up the threat of Islamic terrorism in Uzbekistan through forced confessions was to ensure that that country remained on side, our side, in the war on terror so that the pipeline could be built. Murray adds, quote, there are designs of this pipeline, and if you look at the deployment of U.S. forces in Afghanistan as against other NATO country forces in Afghanistan, you'll see that undoubtedly the U.S. forces are positioned to guard the pipeline route. It's what it's about. It's about money. It's about oil. It's not about democracy, end quote. Really? Damn. The Trans-Afghanistan pipeline is slated to be completed in 2014 with $7.6 billion in funding from the Asian Development Bank. And by the way, Craig Murray was dismissed from his position as ambassador in 2004 following his first public allegations that the British government relied on torture in Uzbekistan for intelligence. It's probably a very, 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 very good thing that we delicate Americans who spend most of our time worrying about some little prick like Glenn Beck, that we don't know what the Bush crime family. Now, you know, I've said before on this program, and you know this anyway, you know, you don't come here to learn things. The U.S. has been involved, or the CIA, U.S. CIA has been involved in torture and overthrowing governments and assassinating people for 50, 60 years. It's not new. I mean, this is not new. What is new is that was then. This is now. Oh, how does that make a difference? Well, it makes a difference because, it makes a difference because, well, I don't know why it makes a difference. So maybe it makes a difference because now it is stepped up. It is worse. Do you think? Now, I know that torture against Vietnamese civilians was extreme. That was perpetrated by, again, the CIA. This is where Richard Armitage, late of the Bush State Department, where he got his experience as a wet man. I believe that's the term. Or he was involved in wet operations. The wet is reference to human blood. But this is what Armitage did in Vietnam. He was involved in the interrogation of Vietnamese villagers in order to determine, you know, when the VC had come in, where the VC had gone, what the VC had done, and why aren't you telling me the truth? Put the son of a bitch back into the boiling oil. You know, that sort of thing. Up to his neck. And then we have the case of Mayor Arar, the Canadian. Remember him? Glenn Greenwald, writing at Salon today, writes that it's not often that an appellate court decision reflects so vividly what a country has become. He's referring to our court, our country. But Glenn writes, such is the case with yesterday's ruling by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in Arar versus Ashcroft. Maher Arar is both a Canadian and Syrian citizen of Syrian descent. He's got dual citizenship, a telecommunications engineer, graduate of Montreal's McGill University. He has lived in Canada since he was 17. In 2002, he was returning home to Canada from vacation when, on a stopover at JFK Airport in New York, he was A, detained by U.S. officials, B, accused of being a terrorist, C, held for 2 weeks incommunicado and without access to counsel while he was abusively interrogated, and then D, was rendered, despite his pleas that he would be tortured, to Syria, where he was interrogated and tortured. He remained in Syria for the next 10 months under the most brutal and inhumane conditions imaginable, where he was repeatedly tortured. Everyone acknowledges that Arar was never involved with terrorism, was guilty of nothing. Glenn appends to the end of some of these comments I'm going to share with you the graphic description from a dissenting judge in this appeals court of what was done to Arar while in American custody and then in Syria. And if you have the guts, stick around because I'm going to share it with you.
To Mike Malloy.
It's 10 before the hour. Ah, torture. I love the smell of napalm early in the morning. We're talking about what Glenn Greenwald wrote at Salon regarding Maher Arar, or Maher, Maher. Let's stick with Maher. Both Canadian and Syrian citizen, dual citizenship, Syrian descent, lived in Canada since he was a kid, grabbed by the CIA, sent to Syria where he was tortured and abused for 10 months. In January 2007, the Canadian Prime Minister publicly apologized to Mayor Arar for the role Canada played in these events, and the Canadian government paid him $9 million in compensation. That was preceded by a full investigation by Canadian authorities and the public disclosure of a detailed report which concluded, quote, categorically, there was no evidence to indicate that Mr. Arar has committed any offense or that his activities constituted a threat to the security of Canada, end quote. But by stark contrast, the U.S. government has never admitted any wrongdoing or even spoken publicly about what we did. To the contrary, the U.S. government repeatedly insisted that courts were barred from examining the conduct of government officials because what we did to Arar involves state secrets. And because courts should not interfere in the actions of the executive where national security is involved. What does that behavioral disparity between the two nations, between the U.S. and Canada, say about how democratic, accountable, and open our country is? Now, Obama, poor President Obama, he didn't ask for this. Poor President Obama. Well, poor President Obama is now as culpable for these outcomes as George W. Bush and Dick Cheney.
Why, Mike?
Because recent efforts by people who were renditioned to seek justice in our courts has been denied under the same State Secrets Act as put out there by Cheney and Bush. Barack Obama, with the stroke of a pen, could end this madness. But he has not, and he will not, nor will his secretary, Attorney General, Eric Holder. Why? You can come up with your own answer, I guess. Tuesday, yesterday, the Second Circuit, here in the United by God States, by a vote of 7-4, agreed with the government, with the Obama government, and dismissed Arar's case in its entirety. It held that if the government violated Arar's constitutional rights as well as statutes banning participation in torture, he still has no right to sue for what was done to him. Why? Because, quote, providing damages remedy against senior officials who implement an extraordinary rendition policy would enmesh the courts ineluctably in an assessment of the validity of the rationale of the policy and its implementation in this particular case, matters that directly affect significant diplomatic and national security concerns. End quote. And that's the way the Obama Justice Department responds. Now, what does it mean? It means, all right, everybody, look, I'm with the Obama government. I'm holding up my right hand. Do you notice which finger I'm holding up? That's right, the middle one. Do you understand what that means? Thank you. Dismissed. In other words, government officials are free to do anything they want in the national security context, Glenn Greenwald writes, even violate the law and purposely cause someone to be tortured. And our courts should honor and defer to these actions by refusing to scrutinize them. So any talk about, oh man, the election yesterday, god damn, they got a Republican up there in New Jersey and a Republican in Virginia. Holy jumping Jesus, man. I guess we're going to take back the country. Oh, forget the 23rd up there in New York. That doesn't mean a thing. To focus on that minutia of garbage droppings, it's raccoon turds. That's all that is. All of it. It's so insignificant. It means nothing. And yet, if you, like I, flipped around through the cable channels today, what did you see? Endless, pointless, ridiculous commentary about, oh, well, now what? Meanwhile, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a resolution condemning the Goldstone report on the atrocities committed by both Israel to a much greater degree than Hamas. We'll have none of that. Now, if you want to condemn Hamas, well, hell yeah, we'll support that. But Israel, hell no! Well, what about our torture renditions and stuff? The government of Canada saw fit to acknowledge its participation or responsibility. But the United States? No. Now, when we come back after the break, I'm going to share with you some of the transcript from the file released by this judge in the Meher Arar case. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. We're talking about Glenn Greenwald's article today at, among other things, at Salon about the case against Meher Arar, Canadian citizen, dual citizenship, and what happened to this man, Canadian and Syrian citizenship. The government of Canada, for its part in the horrible circumstances that he found himself in. The Canadian government responded in the only appropriate way that it could. You cannot give back to a person who's been tortured his integrity or his decency or his spirituality. It's been stripped. That's the whole purpose of torture. The Canadians did the best they could. The United States government tells Meher Arar to go screw himself. As Glenn Greenwald writes, reflecting the type of people who fill our judiciary, the judges in the majority, this ruling was, I think, 7-4, that his case should be dismissed because we ain't going to allow no torture victim to sue anybody in our country. The judges in the majority also invented the most morally depraved bureaucratic requirements for Arar to proceed with his case and then claimed he had failed to meet those requirements. Arar did not, for instance, have the names of the individuals who detained and abused him at JFK, which the majority said he must have. The majority in the court said, well, you got to have the names. What the goddamn, what does that mean? One of the judges in dissent, Judge Sack, said of that requirement, quote, it means government miscreants may avoid liability altogether through the simple expedient of wearing hoods while inflicting injury, end quote. And then Glenn quotes from Harper Magazine, Scott Horton, who also commented on this today. And Horton perfectly captures the depravity of what our government has done and continues to do to Maher Arar. Scott Horton's analysis should be read in its entirety, but he concludes with this. Quote, when the history of the Second Circuit is written, the Arar decision will have a prominent place. It offers all the historical foresight of Dred Scott, in which the court rallied to the cause of slavery, and all the commitment to constitutional principles of the slaughterhouse cases in which the 14th Amendment was eviscerated. The court that once affirmed that those who torture are the enemies of all mankind now tells us that U.S. government officials can torture without worry because the security of our state might someday depend upon it. End quote. Scott Horton. Glenn Greenwald says, I want to add one principal point to all this. This is precisely how the character of the country becomes fundamentally degraded when it becomes a state in permanent war. So continuous are the inhumane and brutal acts of government leaders that the citizens completely lose the capacity for moral outrage and horror. Let me repeat that. So continuous are the inhumane or brutal acts of government leaders that the citizens completely lose the capacity for moral outrage and horror. Now, let me digress from Glenn's excellent article. That's precisely what has happened in this country. And the lead phalanx of that group of people are those who watch Fox, those who are Republicans, those who are conservatives. They have completely lost the capacity for moral outrage and horror, unless it's about giving everybody health care, these degenerate sons of bitches. Back to Greenwald. The permanent claims of existential threats from an endless array of enemies, which is what we're dealing with now, means that secrecy is paramount, accountability is deemed a luxury, and national security trumps every other consideration, even including basic liberties and the rule of law. Worst of all, the president takes on the attributes of a protector deity who can and must never be questioned lest we prevent him from keeping us safe. Now, of course, we expect that kind of insanity out of conservatives or Republicans or Dick Cheney or George W. Bush. But my goodness, we have Barack Obama. From one of the dissenting judges in this horrible case, I think it's Judge Sack. Is that it? Yeah. One of the dissenting judges in the 7-3 ruling. Do you understand what this ruling means? It means 7-4 ruling. It means what Scott Horton and Glenn Greenwald are clearly articulating. Here's from the Arar's detention in Syria. During his 10-month period of detention in Syria, Arar alleges he was placed in a grave cell measuring six feet long, 7 feet high, and 3 feet wide. The cell was located within the Palestine branch of the Syrian military intelligence. The cell was damp and cold, contained very little light, and was infested with rats, which would enter the cell through a small aperture in the ceiling. Cats would urinate on Arar through the aperture, and sanitary facilities were non-existent. Arar was allowed to bathe himself in cold water once per week. He was prohibited from exercising and was provided barely edible food. He lost 40 pounds during his 10-month period of detention in Syria. During his first 12 days in Syrian detention, Arar was interrogated for 18 hours per day and was physically and psychologically tortured. He was beaten on his palms, his hips, and lower back with 2-inch thick electric cable. His captors also used their fists to beat him on his stomach, his face, and the back of his neck. He was subjected to excruciating pain and pleaded with his captors to stop, but they would not. He was placed in a room where he could hear the screams of other detainees being tortured and was told that he, too, would be placed in a spine-breaking chair hung upside down in a tire for beatings and subjected to electric shocks. To lessen his exposure to the torture, Arar falsely confessed, among other things, to having trained with terrorists in Afghanistan, even though he had never been to Afghanistan and had never been involved in terrorist activity. Arar says that his interrogation in Syria was coordinated and planned by U.S. officials, who sent the Syrians a dossier containing specific questions. As support for this allegation, Arar notes that the interrogations in the United States and Syria contained identical questions, including a specific question about his relationship with a particular individual wanted for terrorism. In return, Arar alleges, the Syrian officials supplied U.S. officials with all information extracted from Arar. Arar cites a statement by one Syrian official who has publicly stated that the Syrian government shared information with the United States that it extracted from him. Now there's more. But I've had enough for this evening. Go to Salon.com, look for Glenn Greenwald's article titled, A Court Decision That Reflects What Type of Country the U.S. Is. And I don't know, maybe not. Maybe that's not a good thing to do. Because, you know, I got an email from somebody who said, well, what can we do about this? You know what the answer is? It's very simple. Nothing. Nothing. Writers like Greenwald and Scott Horton, talk show hosts like me, philosophers and people who are immersed in human rights, people who love peace and justice, people who believe that any sort of torture on this planet degrades the entire human race. All of that stuff is all well and good, but you know what it means in the big picture? We've turned a corner. It means nothing.
Why are we all fighting? Huh? Why do we keep on lighting these fires, these bombs? We don't know what's gone wrong. Forgetting and all of this violence is killing me.
Stand back. Here come 50,000 watts of free speech. It's Mike Malloy.
Whew. What else we got? You know, torture really is the, it's a hallmark of a country or a state or a nation, whatever, that, will eventually, sooner rather than later, end, and it will end in a puddle of its own excrement. Because that, I mean, torture and the kind of stuff that's been going on by, very openly and directly and to a much greater degree than 50 years ago, 40 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago. I mean, it's so totally out of control now. It's to the point, well, I don't mean out of control. It is utterly under control. It is part of U.S. foreign policy. And the courts are upholding the right of the executive to do this in this country. You know, I suggested the other night, very seriously suggested that the way Barack Obama can find his way out of the mess in Afghanistan is to simply, you know, notify the American people he's going to do it and then do it, go before Congress and ask for a declaration of war if they feel that our adventures in Afghanistan are truly in the interest of national security or whatever. You know, let's stipulate that the truth shall remain out of the discussion between Barack Obama and the Congress. Because the truth is, I mean, Barack Obama could not go into Congress and say, I need a declaration of war. If you want to go to war, let's go to war. because we have a pipeline to build. We have natural resources that if we don't go glom it up, the Chinese are going to get it. The Russians may get it just to get it, just to stick a finger in our eyes. So we need to go kill, and we need to sacrifice, oh, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9,000 of our young men and women into the death machine so that we can get this. Now, give me a resolution. Or he could go and say, look, this whole thing is madness. And like Pilate, I'm going to try to wash my hands of the affair. If you want me to be the commander-in-chief, then give me what the Constitution requires that you give me, a declaration of war against Afghanistan. Now, of course, Afghanistan is run by our puppets, so I don't know how you're going to do this. Unless we just declare war against our puppet. I guess that's okay, right? In the past, we put in our puppets, and when they are no longer effective, we remove them. We end their puppetry. We take them away so that they are no longer the head of government. We have them hanged, or they disappear in mysterious plane crashes. The hanged one would be, of course, Saddam Hussein. The plane, Hussein, the plane crash would be Omar Torrijos, of Panama. The one who, I mean, just take your own pick. Diem was assassinated. Once our puppets no longer are our puppets, they run into all kinds of problems. So, Hamid Karzai would just have to deal with the declaration of war against his country. If you folks in Congress want to do this. Now, that's all Barack Obama has to do, right? Then he's off the hook. And nobody can scream at him, get in his face, because all he said is, hey, let's go back to the Constitution. How do we declare war? How do we invade, occupy, and murder in other countries? How do we justify the deaths of our own young men and now women in combat? How do we do that? Well, we do it through a mechanism called a declaration of war. After that declaration is made, all sorts of interesting extrajudicial aspects recognized by the judiciary come into play. And then everybody's ass is protected, and 50 years from now they'll talk about the greatest generation that stopped Muslim extremism. But he won't do that. Now, why won't Barack Obama do that? Why not? Because we are not that country any longer. We're not the United States, just maybe 40 years into our attempt to dominate everything, and we get slapped across the face by the Japanese. And as a result of that smash in the face that took 2,800 lives, FDR gets, he gets a declaration of war. Off we go. And for the next 4 years, we just beat the living Christ out of the fascists. We just smash them. And we do it in the name of freedom, justice, and American pie. But what we're really doing it is in the name of American corporatism and capitalism. But okay, it worked. It was great. It was the America, the second half of the American century, which is now over. So why won't Obama do, why won't he take my suggestion, ask for a declaration of war? Because he doesn't have to anymore. And because to whatever degree he does or does not feel some perverse pleasure in being the commander-in-chief, his actions are determined by, well, the puppeteers. Because truth be told, is Barack Obama any less of a puppet than Hamid Karzai? Huh? Seriously. Is he any less of a puppet, Barack Obama? He's better looking than Hamid Karzai. He's more articulate. His speeches still just fill me with pride in being an American. But is he any less a puppet than Hamid Karzai?
No more Mr. Nice Guy. Here's Mike Malloy.
I would walk 10 miles on my hands and knees to
25 before the hour. Oh, by the way, the U.S. State Department spokesman Ian Kelly told reporters today, quote, "We are disappointed by the verdicts against the Americans and Italians charged in Milan for their alleged involvement in the case involving Egyptian cleric Abu Omar," end quote. Well, you can tell the attitude of the U.S. government. He says, "We're disappointed by the verdicts against the Americans and Italians charged in Milan." No, they were convicted in Milan. And then he says, "For their alleged involvement." No, it's a matter of record now. Their involvement. You see, Mr. Kelly, once, you know, when somebody's arrested, they are charged with the crime. The crime being their alleged involvement in criminal activity. But after the trial, it's no longer a charge. It's a conviction. Ah, but you see, we don't recognize that kind of law. Mr. Kelly declined further comment pending a written opinion from the judge. He says he expects the case will be appealed. Well, of course, you know, of course we'll appeal it. We can't allow some half-ass Italian court to decide that our people are guilty of crimes against humanity, violating the, well, that's not what they were charged with, of course, violating the laws of a sovereign nation, i.e. Italy, upon whom we depend. For how many soldiers does Italy send to Afghanistan? How many did they send to Iraq? You know? Oh, well. Regarding what to do, oh my goodness, Chicken Little, what to do, Prairie 2 says it's a cliche that knowledge is power, but it's true. If enough patience and persistence is applied, I don't mean you can solve anything or come up with a plan, but the more that you know, the more often you will know what to say or do. Conservatives drill on talking points for this purpose. Knowledge can spread if you keep speaking the truth. When enough people know enough truth, then they become that irresistible force that tyrants cannot turn back. Sounds simplistic, but it has always worked. The right has made it work, but of course, they make their own reality. Real reality will trump made-up reality if enough people know the difference, the naked emperor being the applicable fable. That in response to, my saying on the air, there's really nothing that we can do about it. It's beyond our ability to affect this at all. I mean, we voted for Barack Obama as a complete repudiation of George W. Bush and the policies of Dick Cheney and all the things that we realized, oddly enough, for the first time in 50 years that we had become. You know, becoming is a process. Once you're there, though, once torture becomes official, sanctioned by the U.S. Justice Department policy of the United States government. You see, that's the difference. You do understand this, don't you, Truth Seeker? All the torture and assassinations and overthrowing of governments and destroying of economies and yada, 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 all that stuff that the CIA and all the other dark, secretive agencies of the U.S. have done over the past 50 or 60 years, none of it was ever official U.S. policy. You did not have a U.S. Justice Department official suggesting to the Attorney General and getting his okay regarding the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran in 1953. That's the difference. You did not have a cadre of attorneys within the Justice Department of the John F. Kennedy writing directives and finding legal excuses for the assassination of Ngoc Dinh Diem in South Vietnam, you see. It just happened. But now it's official U.S. policy. You do see the difference. So when someone says to you, well, that crap's been going on for 50 years, yawn. No. The action may have been going on for 50 years, but the fact that it has been sanctioned now, it is part of our foreign policy, our national security. We have lawyers in the Justice Department who issue rulings, yes, rulings that say, okay, that's all right. No, go ahead. Information gathered from torture is acceptable because we are in a unique position. We are fighting a death struggle with Islamic whatever and terror and yada, yada, yada. So, no, it's all okay now. Go ahead. But, of course, Barack Obama ended all that, right? We don't torture anymore. As a matter of fact, George W. Bush ended all that, right? We don't torture anymore. From Jonesboro, Tennessee, there's a guy out there named Jim Stevens. And he admits he's not a particularly religious person. But he says he's awed by what he has seen nearly every morning for the last couple of weeks on the driver's side window of his Isuzu pickup truck. It was 2 weeks ago today that an image resembling the face of Jesus Christ made its first appearance on the window. Stevens, who said he has a bum shoulder, was having friends from Rogersville, Tennessee, help move some items. He entered his truck from the passenger side to put his drink inside the vehicle. He said when he went around the truck to the driver's side, the image was there. It's the face of Jesus. Initially, Mr. Stevens said he figured the image would go away, and that would be the end of it. But since it first showed up, the morning dew has led to the appearance of the image. Later in the day, when the dew from the morning evaporates, Stephen said the image goes with it. However, when the dew returns the next morning, so does the image on the window of his pickup truck. Even rolling the window up and down, up and down, up and down, has not stopped it from reappearing. Mr. Stevens said no matter who sees the image, the reaction is the same, as a recent trip to the grocery store proved. He said a woman at the store had seen the image prior to his entering. By this time, Stevens had bought a few small items. A number of the store's employees and patrons had been out to catch a glimpse of his window. He said, quote, there was no doubt when they came out that they saw what they saw, end quote. Stephen said he has not done anything to or had anything in the truck to explain the sudden appearance of the image of the face of Jesus Christ. However, he's not ready to see it go. He said at the window, quote, of course I'm not going to wash it, end quote. Stephen said he believes strange things happen and that he has no explanation for the image on his truck's window. He said, quote, what happened to me? I don't know. I have no idea. Now, what is the interesting part of this story? Come on, think for a minute. The interesting part of the story is that Jim Stevens does not have an Hispanic surname. Right? Isn't it always our Latino brothers and sisters who see images of the Virgin Mary all over the place in a tortilla, on a potato chip, in a window at a Macy's department. But this guy, you know, his name is not Jorge Rodriguez. His name is Jim Stevens. He's a white guy, an actual European American. He's not an Hispanic American. He's European American. If you go to the Johnson City Press newspaper website, you can check him out. Yes.
Didn't we have Spaghetti Jesus up on a billboard here in Atlanta?
We did.
For like a spaghetti warehouse or spaghetti factory restaurant.
Well, that was just kind of a joke.
No.
Somebody saw Jesus in a plate of spaghetti.
And it was a fork full of spaghetti that was hoisted above a giant plate of spaghetti on a billboard on 75, I think, near the Big Chicken, which means nothing to anyone unless you live in Atlanta, and then everyone knows what the Big Chicken is. But there was an image of Jesus' face suspended in the fork full of spaghetti.
Why are these pictures of Jesus always very similar to medieval renditions by painters during the church Renaissance years? Why is Jesus never depicted as what he actually was, a swarthy, dark-skinned, squat, curly-haired Jew who may have been of enough African descent to have been more than just dark-skinned? He might have been actually an African-African, or an African-Palestinian. He was a Palestinian Jew who was short, squat, by just by the descriptions offered up by what would be the term, ethnobiographers, not historians, people who understand what folks look like in that part of the world, you know, 2200, 2300, 2000 years ago. But of course, the image that these people always see in their pickup trucks or wherever in a plate of spaghetti is this light-skinned, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, you know, strong chin, nice thin lips and a straight nose. Jesus. Weird.
Well, this Jesus here in Atlanta looked a little like Chef Boyardee.
Chef Boyardee, yeah. Well, we'll be back after the break. You want to chat? Let's open up the phone lines. The number here is 877-996-2556. I'd like to hear from somebody in Boston. If you are really listening, they joined our list of affiliates last night. AM 1510 in Boston, WWZN. The number here again is 877-996-2556.
It's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
This portion of the Mike Malloy Show is brought to you by the 1.6 million members of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, fighting for real health care reform. It is 9 before the hour. Tell Mr. Stevens that people see faces when they take acid and shrooms too, and so do schizophrenics for that matter. Really? All right, one last thing on the election last night that has the mouth breathers just thrilled. Well, Kathy wrote about it at her blog today at MikeMalloy.com. You might want to read that. But from Washington Monthly, this, as everyone now knows, Bill Owens, that was the guy in the 23rd District in New York, will be the first Democrat to represent New York's 23rd since the mid-19th century after defeating the conservative Doug Hoffman yesterday. Makes you think a little bit about the representation of the region. New York has 29 congressional districts. As of today, the state is represented by 27 Democrats. As recently as a few years ago, Democrats only had 21 seats from New York. And in addition, New England, made up of six states, has 22 congressional districts. Currently, the region is represented by 22 Democrats. So, north of the Pennsylvania border, there are 51 congressional districts representing 34 million people. Republicans have two seats of the 51.
Oh, well, you see, this just proves it, doesn't it? Obama's toast. Democratic Party's toast. By the way, can somebody get me some drugs? Whatever happened to my cleaning woman? Want to see me bounce? You like my man boobs? Ah, you think I'm losing a little weight? Well, it's because I'm doing drugs again. On to your calls. David is in Chicago. Hey, David.
Hey, Mike, what's up?
You are.
Oh, man. It's good to hear your voice again. I'm just trying to figure out why everybody is not asking the same types of questions you are. And I just wanted to say, you know, thanks for keeping up the pressure on government. And I was telling, you know, whoever answered the phone that it amazes me that nobody thinks about the rights that we lost under George Bush and Nancy Pelosi mm-hmm. under the Patriot Act and the torture, the abuses at home and abroad. But they really seem slow to adopt the change that everyone's been talking about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I got in an argument with a Republican, and now it's kind of strange that he was saying, well, Obama was your man, dude. I said, no. What I said was that our government is a government of laws. And right. that to suspend habeas corpus under George Bush was just as wrong. And unless Barack Obama, a constitutional lawyer, changes that direction and makes that, you know, the foundational principle that no one's king. Mm-hmm. And you just can't, you know, say that someone is a bad guy without proving it. And that type of whole thing, it's not a Democratic issue or Republican issue. It bleeds over into our foreign policy. So I was hearing part of what you were saying, and I was like saying nobody is getting it. Mm-hmm. You know, they're all thinking it's a political thing. If George Bush was in power for 8 years, who's to say that another George Bush will not arise? And because Obama has not changed fundamentally back to what we were guaranteed as a people mm-hmm. and made it, you know, unless he's taking a strong stance and saying, you know what, I'm not going to be Bush-like. Right. I'm not going to just say, well, you know what, George Bush didn't craft this policy wrong. You know, I'm going to say that he was wrong. What he did was wrong to the American people in the violation of their fundamental rights. And what he did abroad in the war and the handling of it, whether you agree it was necessary or not, I don't care if it's Afghanistan now or Iraq before. What he did and the underlying thing that we got into it about was that the criminality of the contract. Anybody nowhere has brought up the fact that none of the money was accounted for then, and nobody's asking any questions about where all the billions of dollars went in these government contracts for Iraq, for Afghanistan,
sure,
and for Korea, and for Katrina, which is still a mess.
Right. Also for Pakistan now. You know, I'll tell you, David, what I think what is happening in the country here, and I think it started in the Reagan years and accelerated, it had kind of a decelerating moment during the Clinton years, oddly enough. But it has re-accelerated to the point where it's almost unstoppable now. And that is this tide of cynicism, this tsunami of cynicism that is part of the political attitude in this country by probably 99% of people who vote, certainly 99% of the public. In general, but let's say maybe 70% of the people who vote, it's just this, and David, thanks, got a boogie here, but it's this tidal wave of cynicism now that is really taking hold. And cynicism equals apathy, and apathy equals silence, and silence equals death. We all know this. Whatever is dying, in this instance, it's constitutional government in the United States of America. So here we go. Cynicism equals apathy, equals silence, equals death. Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. This portion of the Mike Malloy Show is brought to you by the 1.6 million members of ASME fighting for real health care reform. Back to your calls here in just a second. As most people know by now who follow national politics or state politics, the gay marriage law in Maine, passed by the legislature, has been rejected, repealed. God, I hate these referenda, these mob rule. I really do. I have an email here from someone who's been writing me quite a bit about this, Tony, who lives in Maine. Let's all stand, Tony writes, and give a round of applause to the religious right for winning yet another battle to defeat the gays. Of course, I'm being sarcastic, and I apologize up front for disjointed letter because I'm so upset right now. I have no idea what I'm going to write or where this is going to lead, but I'm so angry at so many different people right now. Let's start with the voters of Maine. When I woke up this morning, I felt ashamed to say that I live in Maine. Voter turnout for an off-year election was almost at record levels, and those who did turn out voted correctly on a number of ballot initiatives, including Yet 53% of them voted to stop same-sex marriage from being legal. I can't understand why anyone would go to the polls and vote to take the legal rights away from any citizen of this state. It's so sickening. I just want to throw up that we live in a country where bigotry is so blatantly allowed. Is this really what our country is all about? And if you've lived in a state where this debate has taken place, you know that it's really an ugly battle. The way people talk about gay men and women, the disgust in their words, the lack of knowing what they're really talking about, it's just an ugly, ugly scenario. You would not believe the hatred that exists out there for this group of people. And then there's the religious right. I'm not even sure what to call them, but somehow they think they have the right to dictate to the rest of us what's right and what's wrong. They have it in their small minds that they are the chosen ones, the ones who hold the moral compass for the entire nation. They're the ones who have taken a book that is basically made up of fables and fairy tales and have decided that it's the book of truth and morality. They pick certain passages and interpret them for their own good. There's nothing written in the Bible that says gay men and women are evil, that their love is a false love. I don't even think the Bible mentions the word gay or homosexual. The only passage I can think of is where it reads, "Man shall not lie with another man." Who knows what that means? For all we know, it could have been misinterpreted. Maybe the person who wrote it had a gay lover who was cheating on him, and in an act of jealousy wrote that. Who knows? All I know is that this is the book that was written thousands of years ago by people who didn't speak English, who thought that thunderstorms, tornadoes, earthquakes, floods were all acts of God. They were people who thought that the world was flat, that the moon and the stars were the home of gods. These were very primitive people, yet we are supposed to believe that this is a book of God's teachings. And there's more, and there's more, and there's more. And finally, my anger is directed to the LGBT leaders, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered. You would think that after 30 states have rejected gay marriage in popular votes, that they would take on a new strategy. I've always been an advocate of civil unions. Instead of pouring all this money and time and effort into a losing cause, they should be contacting members of Congress and the Senate to pass a nationwide civil union bill that would give gay men and women and even straight folks who don't want any religious aspect involving marriage to go to their town halls, file for a civil union license, and still enjoy the same rights as married people. But no. The LGBT leaders continue to march forward in trying to beat a religious bloc that is way stronger and more well-funded than any gay group. We are now 0 out of 31. You would think a new way of thinking would be in order. And what good does it do for those who live in the 5 states that have gay marriage? Their marriage is only recognized by that state. So if a gay couple in Massachusetts wants to move to Florida, their marriage is null and void. And the biggest loser of all is, in all of this, is Jesus. The man who gave his life for mankind, the man who didn't have any worldly possessions, a man who dedicated his life to helping the needy, the poor, the sick, a man who taught the lessons of love, respect, peace, and dignity, all of that to have a religion who uses his name to take the rights away from those who have done nothing but try and live a normal, peaceful life with the person they love. I'm sure he's feeling as ill as I am at this moment. Oh, yeah. As you know, Mike, Maine is known for its lobsters. So do you think the next question on the ballot will be to make lobster fishing, clamming and scalp fishing illegal in the state? I mean, we all know that shellfish are an abomination. Hope you and Kathy have a good show. Yeah, I hear you. Jesus, Tony. I mean, I know. I know. Yeah, I've always been astonished at the willingness of, and that's because I'm not a behavioral sciences researcher, who are not shocked by the fact that 53% of the voters who turned out the other day in Maine will vote as a group to deny people in their state a civil right that they, the voter, has. I am hetero. I can get married. You are goddamn queer. You cannot. I mean, what is that? To take the trouble to cast a ballot, to deny a basic, call it what you want, civil right, human right. What kind of a person will do that? What kind of person will say, be so confused? Marriage has not a goddamn thing to do with religion. It is a contract. Just like if you contract with an exterminator to come to your house every month and get rid of the roaches. You have a contract. Marriage is a contract sanctioned by the state. How many times do we go over this? And why is it that the Christian freaks don't understand this? Any Christian minister must say at the conclusion of his getting the potential bride and groom to recite the vows, and now by the power vested in me by the state of fill in the blank, I pronounce you husband and wife. By the power vested, not by the power vested in me by Jesus or God or the Ten Commandments or Moses or Muhammad, by the power vested in me by the state of Georgia, Massachusetts, Alabama, whatever. Why is that so hard for these religious freaks to understand? Look, all you Baptists and Catholics and Presbyterians and Orthodox Jews and yada yada, if you don't want to sanction a gay marriage, then hang a notice on the front of your church, your synagogue, your temple, your mosque that says, "We don't marry queers here. Go to the courthouse." I mean, why, you know, is that so difficult? And then if you are a nice Bible-thumping Christian and you believe that it's an abomination, it's also none of your goddamn business what two consenting adults do, is it? I mean, there have been Supreme Court rulings on that. Are you not aware of that? Oh, well. I'm not going to get all head up about this because you know my feelings about religion. But removing the religious aspect and just looking at the political aspect for Americans, for people who should know better, right? I mean, we're American, you know, so we started in slavery and genocide, doesn't matter. We're American, God damn it. We believe we've got people over in Iraq and Afghanistan willing to die for human rights. But we're not going to let the queers get married here in Maine. What kind of asininity is that? I mean, what is that? All right, your phone calls when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy.
When your lover's in a dangerous time, sometimes you're made to feel as if your love's a crime. Nothing worth having comes without some kind of fight. God.
do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Gordon in Oklahoma City has a solution for this vote in Maine yesterday. Gordon writes, Mike, my solution is to score a consecrated communion wafer and hold it hostage until the Roman Catholic Church agrees to keep their theology concerning gay marriage to themselves. That is to say, within their own church walls, and not invoking their narrow beliefs on the rest of society. Yeah, well, of course, it's not just the Roman Catholic Church, though, and I'm sure Gordon knows that. But I like that idea. Grab a consecrated communion wafer and hold it hostage. I have here the body of Jesus. Whew. I wonder how long it would take before some Catholic fundamentalists, like Muslim fundamentalists, would track down the person holding the consecrated wafer and behead him in much the same way they did to John the Baptist. Was it John the Baptist got beheaded? Yeah, I think it was. Not that it matters. Frank is in Illinois. Hey, Frank.
Hey, Mike, how you doing tonight?
I'm all right. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. Hey, the gentleman in Tennessee that doesn't know how his truck got that way, I guess he can't figure out that the kid came out of McDonald's with greasy hands on a skateboard and bounced into the side of his truck.
Well, yeah, but...
here's the deal, though. You know, if he plays it right, you know, it could be better than cash for clunkers, because put that baby on eBay and one of those fundamentalists... will pay thousands for that truck. You
that,
know?
That's
if
true.
If I remember correctly, there was somebody on eBay a couple of years ago that paid $2,500 for a piece of burnt toast that looked like the Shroud of Turin.
I think so. It's stunning how you can, you know, there's money in the God business for sure.
The good word goes out, the long green comes in. But actually, the reason that I called was regarding the deal in Italy. They were interviewing a former prosecutor. And he was obviously functioning in a pundocratic capacity now.
Uh-huh.
And they asked him whether or not, you know, what his opinion was of the conviction and this, that, and the other. And was it legit? And he said, well, yeah, sure. They're guilty as hell. But, hey, you know, this is a war on terror. So, you know, you got to do what you got to do. So
right.
I don't think that the slippery slope of the ends justify the means is just an American phenomenon. I think there's a whole lot of people on the face of this earth that are starting to feel that way.
Well, I think you're right. And perverting the law, obviously, is nothing new. I mean, it's been done in nations that have laws. It's been done with alarming regularity. But the thing that bothers me about us is it's us. I mean, I several weeks ago, I completely bought into the myths. The mythology, the stories about what this country was all about, what it was supposed to do, where it concerned the rest of the world, and even though we were founded in genocide and slavery, I mean absolute murder and of the most foul, and bringing people over from Africa where millions died in the so-called Middle Passage, and I mean all this horror, but. But somehow, you know, we were supposed to transcend all that and work our way out of it. So I bought the myths. You know, I bought into all that stuff, as I think most Americans of a certain age did. We were the good guys. They were the bad guys, you know. And now, of course, we realize that that is just not the case. Hey, Frank, got to move on. Thank you. I appreciate you checking in, pal. Warren is in Boston listening on... 1510, the revolution, is that what that's what y'all call the station?
That's what they call it. I first heard it yesterday.
Oh, yeah? Really? Oh, see.
I was listening to you on Sirius when you mentioned it.
Yeah?
And I went over to my other little radio there and turned off the Sirius, turned it on, and I was amazed.
Bingo. Yeah. Well,
you haven't been on the air here since the old Air America days.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we're really thrilled to be back in Boston. Hey, do me a favor and just spread the word just a little bit, all right?
Oh, I've been spreading the word for a while.
Oh, great. Okay, yeah. Now what you're really called about.
Okay, yeah, well, I happen to be from Maine.
Yeah.
I'm not from the lobster part. I'm from the potato part.
Yeah?
I guess they didn't have potatoes in the Middle East, so they wouldn't have been an abomination.
That's true. I just occurred to me. I never think about Maine potatoes. I think about
nobody ever thinks past the coast.
I know. I think about Maine lobsters, or people that talk sort of different. You know, there's Maine blueberries, I guess, but I never think of Maine potatoes. Hey, hold on a second. I got to do a break. Can you hold on?
Yeah, sure.
All right, let me put you on hold. We'll come back here in just a second. Yeah, I'm thinking of Idaho potatoes. but I guess it's the interior of the state, right? All right. We have to take a quick break. We'll come right back and pick it up with Warren and also try to get your calls, too, before the program's over tonight. So stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Radio done right from the left. It's Mike Malloy.
Yes, it is. 26 before the hour. Excuse me. We're talking to Warren, who is listening tonight on AM 1510 in Boston. All right. You were talking to us about Maine potatoes and Maine lobsters. Well, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's not really what I called it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
yeah, I'm from northern Maine.
Right.
Which is probably one of the parts of the state that, you know, where the Jesus goose steppers were out in force, you know.
Really? Is that the part of the state that is...
the northern part.
Known for that. Really?
Aroostook County, Washington County, the western part. You know, the rural parts of the state, it's kind of a microcosm, you know. You get into the cities like... cities, if you want to call them that, like Bangor and Portland, it's more progressive.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know about Bangor, but I don't know how many people from Maine are listening, you know, but I mean, I'm pretty disgusted by the whole thing. I don't have any plans on marrying anybody anytime soon, but I'm bisexual, and you know, I don't like the idea of having, you know, any part of the country ripping away people's civil rights, you know, on some, you know, bogus referendum that they shouldn't even be having, you know.
Well, no, and you know, that's why we are a democratic republic and not a democracy, is specifically to be able to rein in these populist moves. You know, let's put a referendum on a ballot in some state that allows this, that says, I firmly believe that left-handed people should be slaves of right-handed people. Now, why not? You know, let's all laugh at that. That sounds ridiculous. But is it any more ridiculous, or less ridiculous, I should say, than saying, let's decide that two people who are in love, because they happen to be the same gender, can't form a contract? I mean, that's all it is. It's a contract where both parties agree to certain terms of a contract. I mean, this is the part that makes me get more upset than I probably should, because I figure that gay folk, just like everybody else who's ever been oppressed by this country or in this country, will figure out a way to transcend this madness and live their lives anyway. So I don't know. It's just such an insulting situation.
Yeah, Yeah, it really is. It makes me glad that I'm living in Massachusetts now, you know.
Well, there you go. Hey, listen, Warren, thanks. And like I say, spread the word about the fact that we're on in Boston, okay?
Oh, yeah.
All right, sir. Take care. Appreciate it. Yeah, it's so American, isn't it? The cynicism flasher is on right now, so watch out. It is so American, isn't it, to go to the polls and vote to deny people civil rights. Now, like I say, if you're a Christian, a Jew, a Muslim, whatever, and you don't like gay marriage, the snappy answer is, okay, then don't have one. But the more logical answer is to say, well, you know, who asked you anyway? It's not your tacky little church or synagogue or mosque that sanctions marriage. It's the state. Now, if someone wants to request the ceremonial aspect of their marriage, and flavor it up with Christianity or set it on fire with some other religious spirit, okay. If they happen to be from a group that your church, synagogue, or mosque doesn't recognize as being fully human, well, then just tell them, no, you can't come in here. Oh, my God. Go away. Go away. Our God is not that strong. My religious faith is not that solid. If you come in here and get married in my church, oh, Jesus, everything will fall down around my ears. Go away. Okay, nobody wants to come into your dumbass house of worship anyway. You know, okay, goodbye. But how dare you pass a law saying that our imaginary little complainer here can't go get married at the courthouse? How dare you? How contemptuous, how disgusting, how petty, how religious to do that? Damn you. Really? That's so counter, isn't it, to the glories of being an American, where we have peace and justice and freedom. Freedom to be in love. The freedom to go down to K Jewelers and buy a blood diamond and put it on our lover's finger, hoping that at some point, isn't that, it's so American to be able to do that, right up to the point where you want to get married. Oh, no!
Not you two. No, no.
Why?
Because you're sodomites, that's why.
What's a sodomite?
Somebody lived in Sodom. It's in the Bible.
And what did the sodomites do?
Some terrible stuff. That's why God threw fire on them.
But the terrible stuff they did was not being welcoming to strangers. I mean, it's in the Bible. That's why God says he destroyed, because they were not welcoming to people who came to the gates of the city and wanted to come in. And the sodomite said, get out of here! And so God said, okay, I will kill you all. Oh, except for Lot. And why do you not be concerned, as long as you're in that mythology, that story, why not be concerned then with what happened with Lot and his daughters afterward? So, incest and subsequent pregnancies in establishing, good God, the house of David. That was okay. But two people of the same gender who want to get married, that's not. You people are crazy. You're lunatics. You're complete lunatics. But you have a right to be that. Now, if I happen to be queer and I want to marry my boyfriend, how do you have the right to tell me I don't have the right? You see? No, you don't. Never mind. Dave is in Huntington Beach, California. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Mike. Good to talk to you again.
My pleasure.
I used to call you back when Prop 8 was going on in California.
Oh, yeah.
And I am a married gay man,
mm-hmm.
One of the 18,000 in California. And So, you know, this whole Prop 1 thing in Maine was obviously disappointing. A lot of the talkers today have been pointing out that while Maine voted down gay marriage rights, they voted overwhelmingly for medical marijuana, and kind of looking at that as sort of a contradiction.
It is, isn't it? I mean, of course, I don't know where in the Bible it says you're not supposed to get high. As a matter of fact, the first miracle that Jesus performed was changing wine to water, or water to wine. And I don't think people drank wine for the resveratrol back in those days. I think they drank wine to get a buzz on.
Could be.
Well, whatever.
But I would point out that in California, when they denied gays civil rights, at the same time, they voted for animal civil rights, farm animal civil rights.
Oh, God.
I don't know if you remember that one.
I vaguely, now that you mention it, it's one of those things I immediately tried to suppress and pretend like it didn't happen.
Well, as this was going on, I read in The Advocate, which is the national gay news magazine, that they were talking to one of the people involved in the campaign against Prop 1 in Maine, and he was saying that he was going to appeal to the fairness of Maine citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I hung my head and said to my husband, this is going down, you know, we're not going to win.
Right, right.
You can't do it that way. And the fact that the gay community hasn't learned that yet is really annoying. We gave a lot of money to the, in fact, our wedding registry was to give money to the No on Eight campaign. And the other side.
You mean the no? You mean
doubt,
the
fear, lies, lies, and lies.
Yeah, yeah.
And the public on issues such as this, they're going to vote their fears.
That's true.
And if we can somehow make them afraid of theocracy, afraid of the Catholics and the Mormons.
And the Baptists and the Methodists.
Well, the Catholics and the Mormons are the ones who gave all the money.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you mean on Prop 8 out in California?
Yeah, and in Maine.
Oh, and in Maine.
Yeah, in fact, my husband was telling me this morning that there was reports of Catholic churches sending the collection plate around twice, once for the church and once for Prop 1.
Oh, God, I'm sorry to laugh, but it just, when you get right down to it, it's the darkest of dark humor. It's the screwiest. I mean, it's like Monty Python skits. Can you imagine a church where they pass the plate around for the starving children in Uganda or someplace, and they say, oh, by the way, we're going to pass around again to defeat the queers wanting to get married in Maine. I mean, that's Monty Python, isn't it?
It is.
It is. Hey, Dave, there's the music. Hey, listen, take care.
You too.
All right, call again. I appreciate you checking in. We'll be back. Thanks to our crew. Also, the glitches in the podcast downloads have been corrected now. I know that for a couple of days here, they've been unreachable. It was a computer program. It was not the fault of anybody involved up the chain here to Ben Birch and to White Rose. It was a computer glitch that has now been, I hope, permanently corrected. Do you think, Kathy? I hope so. So thanks to our crew, Bruce Enberg, Sharon Gordy, Ben Birch, Kay Petrini, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, and Kathy Bay, who's the executive producer of the program. Also, those of you who have been streaming online or listening online tonight, the music provided by my good friend Kevin Kinney. So for those of you who say, well, who's Kevin Kinney? You always see on Friday night, have a great weekend, Kevin Kinney, wherever you are. That's him. And that's his band, Driving and Crying. They have a new album out. Go to kevinkinney.com. and see what they're about. This is from Scott in Somerville, Massachusetts. Yo, Mike, I'm also a Boston listener, longtime fan, streamed you online for a year or more, and now you're on the radio here. He's referring to the revolution, AM 1510. Now I am liberated. I can leave my computer and hear your show in my car or some of the other rooms in the house, in my loft. He says, parenthetically, all liberals in Boston live in lofts. Scott in Somerville, Mass. Thanks, Scott. Hey, get the word out. Pass the word, okay? This just in, as they say, the United Nations is preparing to announce the withdrawal of a number of its staff operating in Afghanistan, according to Al Jazeera. The move comes a week after five UN personnel were killed in a Taliban attack in Kabul. The imminent announcement on Thursday follows an unannounced visit by Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, to the Afghan capital. Ban urged Hamid Karzai, the Afghan president, to beef up security for UN staff working in the country. The suicide attack, which left five UN employees dead, targeted the Bektar guest house. In a statement afterwards, the Taliban said it had attacked the UN because of its involvement in organizing Afghanistan's presidential elections, the second round of which has since been called off. The UN assistance mission in Afghanistan is composed of roughly 1,100 foreign personnel working across the country, in addition to about 5,600 local staff. Yada, yada, yada. So look for that announcement tomorrow. The UN is reducing its presence in Afghanistan just at a time when the President of the United States is considering increasing ours. For some reason, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense, does it? Troy is in Indianapolis, listening on XM. Hey, Troy.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Pretty good. I actually just discovered your program tonight. I was flipping through the channels and came across this.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. And I was so glad to catch you when you were talking about the results of the main election.
Right.
With the same-sex results. I, myself, am a conservative Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And like I was telling your screener, I'm a conservative Christian that is really disappointed in the way the church has handled this topic throughout the ages. When I think about the way we so-called Christians react to people who want to enter into a loving relationship because of the fact that we claim things like it's a change in the definition of marriage, when you look at Scripture, the very first place that the definition, and I'll use that word in quotes, that the definition of marriage was changed,
mm-hmm.
because the Christians tried to use Genesis, where it said there was Adam and Eve. But the very first time that someone took more than one wife, when the definition was no longer more one man, one woman,
mm-hmm.
actually takes place in Genesis. And when you look, of course, through all the patriarchs of those within the Old Testament who also had more than one wife, and you look at the way God reacted to them.
Right. Take a look at
Christians react to those who are gay. It's completely...
How do Christians explain Solomon or David, who had not only wives but lovers, concubines, a whole castle, a whole palace full? How do they explain that?
Well, the thing is, we're told to be able to follow Christ in His footsteps.
Oh, I see. Even though Jesus, supposedly, according to the mythology, is of the house of David, and let's not forget that David is of the house of Lot, and let's not forget that Lot had sex with his two daughters to impregnate them. That's what they wanted. So, consequently, I guess if you work it down and backwards, Jesus is the direct offspring of incest.
Absolutely, and not just that, but if you go back, if you work back even further, you mentioned earlier the Genesis account. When you look at the fact where Lot was willing to throw his daughters, you know, to the mob to try to appease them, if you want to put that story in a homosexual context, one of the first things you'll notice is that Lot is not condemned for his actions.
Right.
And when you consider the fact, what's so funny is that if you want to go ahead and go down that road of using that story to say that it's a homosexual context, well, go ahead and follow it through to its logical conclusion. Obviously, what you're saying is that the next time a mob of homosexuals can come towards you because of the fact that Lot isn't condemned for his actions, then it's perfectly okay to throw your daughters at them and in a sense to be able to appease them. But that doesn't make sense. We know it doesn't make sense.
No, it does. On the most immediate level that it doesn't make sense is the fact that any time you have a mob of homosexuals, they're probably going to go dancing. You know, or they're in a dance club. Hey, listen, I got to leave there, Troy. I appreciate your insights. Thank you. And good to hear from you. And if you're still on hold, we just don't have any time left tonight. So we'll try to get your call tomorrow. That whole first hour of the program tonight was just unnerving to me. I'm probably going to go have bad dreams now thinking about Maher Arar. What he went through, a totally innocent person. Can you imagine? This is like Kafka, isn't it? It's like Metamorphosis. It's like The Prisoner. It's Arar, the Canadian Syrian, who was tortured, renditioned. The Canadian government has had the decency to settle with him in the only way they can financially. The American government says, get out of town. But it's like something from Kafka. I mean, can you imagine what Arar went through? Oh, well, we did this the first hour. I don't know. I'll see you tomorrow night. Okay, take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. Burdened.